How well can cancer specialists assess how well a particular treatment is destroying a tumor? It is true that there are methods to make this determination, but it could take weeks of observation before knowing whether the tumor has responded and shrunk down in size. Is it possible to develop a means of detecting the efficacy of a treatment by looking at the cancer at the cellular level? Researchers at the Stanford University School of Medicine in California reported in a study published in the April 12th online issue of the journal Nature Medicine an approach that may just answer this question. And I'm pleased to introduce Dr. Dean Felscher, Associate Professor of Medicine and Pathology and the leader of the Stanford Molecular Therapeutics Program, Stanford University School of Medicine, and oncologist at the Stanford Cancer Center and senior study author. Good afternoon.
A pleasure to be on your show.
Well, I'm very excited about this because up to now, at least my understanding is that it is at times difficult to determine how well a treatment protocol is working for patients who are obviously suffering with various cancers. And my question is, what are the standard methods in use today to help oncologists determine the efficacy of the cancer treatments being used in their patients?
Well, today, the vast majority of time when we decide if a therapeutic is working in a patient, we wait to see if we can measure the tumor has decreased in overall size or overall biologic activity using either physical measurements or by using imaging techniques such as CAT scans or PET scans. And this approach, of course, as you realize as a fellow physician, means that you have to wait. You have to wait a significant amount of time after you deliver the therapeutic to make a judgment on whether or not that therapeutic is actually helping your patient.
So in an ideal clinical evaluative process, what would help oncologists make assessments that are more accurate?
Well, ideally, there are two things that we'd all like to be able to do as physicians. One thing is we'd like to be able to do a test that would let us know, even before we start a therapy, what the chances are that that patient would respond to a particular therapy. And in many medical disciplines, we can do that. Mm-hmm. If, as a cardiologist, we can make a measurement on certain kinds of things in the blood, such as cholesterol, and we know that if we give a drug, we can lower that cholesterol level. In cancer, it's much harder to know what to measure to tell whether or not a patient's going to respond to a particular therapeutic. The second problem is that we'd like to be able to address after we give the drug whether or not a patient is really responding to the drug. Mm-hmm. And to go back to the analogy of the cardiologist, if he gives a drug to lower cholesterol, he would give the drug knowing the patient's cholesterol is high, knowing that's a problem. He'd give the agent to lower cholesterol, and he'd be able to measure the cholesterol afterwards and show cholesterol level has lowered. In cancer, we don't have, in many cases, the molecules that we know to measure to tell when a patient's going to respond to a particular type of therapy. And we don't have the molecules to measure after we give a therapeutic. We also don't have a way to make these measurements. And the purpose of our study largely was to develop a technology that could be used to make exactly these kind of measurements, mm-hmm. so we could figure out things like a cholesterol measurement that would be useful to tell us when to give a particular therapy and whether or not the therapy is working.
So this segues very nicely into my next question is that what was the basic science that led to the development of your research with regards to sort of the pathophysiology of cancers at the cellular level? What clues from that pathophysiology helped in developing this particular study and the ideas of, exactly as you said, finding some markers or finding something that you can measure?
Well, my work for the last now 15 years has focused on trying to develop experimental circumstances where I can know that modulating the function of a specific gene will have a good effect in cancer. And what we had shown was that there are certain broken genes that if you fix them, this has a very dramatic consequence for a cancer. And it leads to a phenomena that we've called, based on another colleague's description, the phenomenon of oncogene addiction. Mm-hmm. And this led us to think, well, if it's really true that cancers can be addicted to a particular broken gene, an oncogene, then we should be able to make measurements to tell us which oncogenes are broken in a cancer. And then if we make drugs that try to turn off those broken genes, we should be able to make a machine that could measure whether or not we're succeeding.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was really the general reason why I pursued the study. And we had an idea that there were certain kinds of broken genes that are very commonly involved in cancer and genes that we're studying in the laboratory. For example, the MYC oncogene is one of the first cancer genes discovered, involved in over half of human cancer, yet currently there are no acceptable, approved therapeutic ways of turning off this broken gene. And so we were interested in our experimental circumstances where we can model what would happen if we could turn off this broken gene. We wanted to have a technology that we could use to validate when were we succeeding in turning off this broken gene. And so the study largely reflects the fact that we were trying to find a way experimentally to determine when we were successfully turning off a broken gene.
And so how did you design that study? What was it that you did to try to answer this question?
So we realized we had to take a big step back because the question was a big question. And we had to think, what was it that we were missing that was allowing us to answer the question? And one of the biggest things that we were missing is we didn't have a technology sensitive enough that it could make measurements in what you'd normally be able to obtain from a clinical specimen, mm-hmm. without doing something very drastic to a patient or in an experimental circumstance requiring a tremendously large amount of material. And so in collaboration with a company that had made a machine that they knew could measure very small amounts of protein and very small amounts of material, they didn't really know what they wanted to use the machine for. We were very excited about mm-hmm. this because we realized we could use this machine to make measurements in our experimental models as well as in humans. And so we set out to see, well, could we use this machine to make measurements in broken cancer genes, oncogenes, in experimental models as well as in human patients from very small amounts of material? And after we did that, we said, well, we can make these measurements. Can we measure a change in these broken proteins in response to therapies? And we were able to show that indeed this machine could allow us in very small amounts of material to show that we could see a change in the activity of a broken cancer gene.
So in other words, if you were through the treatment able to shut down that gene that the cancer cell was using, and given that the gene is coding for a particular protein, you would see a reduction in that specific protein as a signal that it was having the effect that you were looking for.
Exactly. We could measure a change in the amount of the protein. This machine also allowed us to measure something that's a little more complicated, but very important to thinking about how you develop a therapy against cancer, was we were not only measuring changes in the amount of these proteins, but whether or not they were phosphorylated and where they were phosphorylated. And phosphorylation is one of the basic mechanisms by which proteins get conditionally turned on or off. They're like light switches on proteins. And this machine could allow us to measure whether or not the protein had decreased in total amount, but also, and perhaps even more importantly, whether or not the protein phosphorylation state had changed.
Now, with regards to the protein chemistry that is going on, are there certain common proteins that are inherent in all the cancer cells? You mentioned the MYC gene, but given that you have different types of cancers, different organ systems that are affected, does the testing require calibration to detect different proteins for different cell types? Is there something along those lines that has to be considered?
That's a very good point. There are hundreds of different kinds of oncogenes. There are several that appear to be particularly commonly involved in cancer, but certain oncogenes are very strongly associated with certain kinds of cancer. And so for any kind of measurement of oncoproteins to be useful to all patients, you'd have to be able to measure hundreds of different proteins.
Mm-hmm.
And the machine that we've been helping to develop is now can measure several dozen different proteins, but one of the major efforts is to try to expand the repertoire of measurements that can be made. You also brought up the point of, well, you need to be able to calibrate. You need to be able to know when you make a measurement, is there really a change?
Right.
And that is also very difficult. It requires having a way of being certain that the machine is very reproducible and that you have controls that allow you to know whether or not, when you get a certain amount of signal, that that really does correspond to a certain amount of protein, and whether or not you can control for the quality of the specimen. Because when you're talking about clinical specimens, blood, biopsies from patients, the way they're handled can have a very strong impact on what measurement you actually obtain.
Especially if your measurements are dealing with, you know, millionths of a gram of a protein, or even less than that, or picograms, or sometimes that's the, you know, very, very small amounts. So yes, I would imagine that the risk of how the sample was taken and possible contamination of the sample could reflect upon the result that you get.
So every major scientific paper, as you know, gets reviewed by blindly. We don't know who's reviewing, by very expert colleagues. We all participate in this process.
Right.
And the reviews often are extremely helpful and help in making you realize what the strengths and weaknesses of your work is. Even when the paper ultimately gets published, you realize there are always things that could be improved.
Sure.
And several of the reviewers, they all pointed out that it would be very important to worry about the fact that when you sample a cancer, it's heterogeneous. There are many different cells, just as you realized.
Right.
And if you're going to look at a very small amount of the specimen, you have to be careful that it's representative and that the measurement you get is really telling you about the entire tumor and that you haven't just happened to go into one part of the tumor that would mislead you into something about the measurement that you get.
Right. So from this then, what are the next steps? What do you want to do now with the information that you have? And also, if I can step back one bit, were there any results in your analysis that were unexpected, either from either a pleasing sort of way or a surprise type of way or something that made you realize that you have to go back and relook at how you approach things? Was there anything like that that happened in the studies?
Well, the most unexpected finding was that even a drug that's used for completely different purposes that we had shown recently had some anti-cancer activity in our experimental model system, and many other people have been studying it for potential anti-cancer properties. We could show that if we gave this drug to patients, that we could detect changes in the level and phosphorylation of an oncoprotein that nobody would have expected would have changed. And so it opened up our eyes to realizing that when we give drugs to patients, even for a purpose entirely different from what we expect, we may very much be affecting the state of different proteins and whether or not they're active or inactive in ways that we weren't able to measure before. And so that was very exciting to us. It meant that there are measurable, significant changes that occur, and many of these had never been characterized, and that this sort of approach could be used to get a much better, depthful insight into when we give a drug to a patient, what's happening to the signaling of their cells.
So in other words, this may even open up avenues or understanding the mechanism of the pathophysiology of the disease itself, because if you weren't expecting those changes and then those changes occurred, obviously something is going on to interfere with the metabolism of that particular cell or cancer that may have not been considered before.
I think you're absolutely right. And in fact, the technology we've brought to Stanford, and we've set up a core facility, and we're actively encouraging our colleagues to use this instrument, not just to study cancer, but to study other kinds of disease processes. And so we have colleagues who are immunologists, we have colleagues who are rheumatologists and neuroscientists who are measuring proteins using this technology to look at other kinds of diseases. And in fact, this leads into what our next step is. Mm-hmm. As you've really already understand the study, obviously, because we really need to do the two things that you have already alluded to, which is expand the repertoire of proteins that can be analyzed and then start using the machine as a strategy for doing what would be referred to scientifically as proteomic analysis.
Right. So
analyzing proteins, large number of proteins, to try to start getting insights into the specific changes in proteins that are associated with disease states. Specifically, our study led to the idea of incorporating this technology into clinical studies as a way to validate that a drug that's thought to target a certain molecule is targeting a certain molecule. And so certainly we're doing that, and that's the more obvious sort of next approach. But more generally, we're interested in the question that you precisely realized. As a fellow internist, I'm always thinking, can we come up with technologies that will help better evidence-based approaches to treatment of medicine, which I know you are a wonderful advocate of.
Thank you. I find this fascinating, too, because here you started off with a specific goal with regards to the study, and all of a sudden all these avenues open up that were potentially unexpected, using this as a tool for determining mechanism of disease as opposed to just measuring the effect of a treatment. And that's what I find one of the joys of looking at science and research is that you never know what direction things go in.
As we both agree that one of the biggest excitements of science and medicine is that when you set out a good study, often the very best, most exciting results were completely unanticipated, which is really a reason why the most important way in which we support science is really to try to provide the best support for the minds that are the most creative, the most willing to move into new directions. Also, it's very important that what we do achieves with the ultimate goal, which is to make findings that not only give us better insight into ourselves and how things work for the sake of scholarship, but most importantly, to gain insights that will really help mankind.
Mm-hmm.
And I would say that has always been, I'm a basic scientist, but I'm a physician, and I've always wanted my results to ultimately lead to a direction that I could say we're going to help all of us.
Dr. Dean Felscher is Associate Professor of Medicine and Pathology and the leader of the Stanford Molecular Therapeutics Program at Stanford University School of Medicine, an oncologist at the Stanford Cancer Center, and senior study author of the research published in the April 12th online issue of the journal Nature Medicine. And Dr. Felscher, I'd like to thank you very much for taking the time to review essentially encapsulating exactly what science is about, the fact that cancer being such an important and devastating illness for many people, and getting the means to understand how things work, and some of the new and exciting avenues that open up from the research itself. And I think it's been just terrific in what you're doing, and I'm excited to see what happens.
Very much appreciate having the opportunity to participate in your show.